Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind, it's been 3 months since Democrats took control of the House. In that time, an historic government shutdown, explosive congressional testimony, multiple investigations, and even some new legislation. But as talk of impeachment buzzes through the Capitol, both Democrats and Republicans seem to be struggling to maintain unity. To help us understand what all this means for legislative priorities in Congress and the balance of power in Washington, I invited Cheryl Gay Stolberg to join me in the studio. She's congressional correspondent for The New York Times. Cheryl, it's great to see you.
Thanks, Diane. It's great to see you.
Before we start talking about what's been happening in Congress, I'd really like to hear your take on why John McCain has become the obsession of this president after he has been dead for 7 months.
You know, I have been thinking a lot about that, Diane, and I think his daughter, Meghan McCain, maybe summed it up. She said that she thinks the president is still jealous of her father, even in death. I don't know why the president is so obsessed with Senator McCain. But then again, why is the president obsessed with anything he obsesses about? I mean, he's still obsessed with Hillary Clinton. She lost the election, and he's still tweeting about crooked Hillary. But it does seem odd that he's going after a man in his grave. And I don't know if you saw, but last night, the McCain Institute, which is an institute that John McCain and his wife Cindy developed, I think to study leadership, put out a long list of John McCain's accomplishments. And it there was no intro. It just said the facts about John McCain.
And these.
And what followed were his military accomplishments, his public service, et cetera, obviously a response to the president.
So you've got members of Congress, to a certain extent, speaking out.
To a certain extent. Johnny Isaacson, the Republican senator from Georgia, spoke out yesterday very pointedly. Before that, by my count, Mitt Romney was the only other Republican senator who had directly criticized the president for his remarks about Senator McCain. Lindsey Graham, who, as a lot of people know, was Senator McCain's best friend, but who is also a close ally of President Trump, played it kind of safe. He said something about the senator and his accomplishments, but he didn't mention the president at all. And of course, Democrats on the other side of the aisle are very critical of the president for going after Senator McCain like this.
What about the audiences in places the president is going? For example, Ohio.
Well, he did not get the kind of reception last night that he usually gets at his rallies. According to our reporters who were there, I think there was kind of a murmur and a little bit of uneasy kind of quiet. And it certainly wasn't an applause line for him.
And apparently his staff is really concerned about this.
Right. Well, look, it distracts from his message to the extent that he has a message. I mean, he's always stepping on his own message with his tweets. And his unpredictable pronouncements. But really, this is a fight that he does not need to have with a man who can't fight back.
And he's also taking on the husband of Kellyanne Conway.
Right. Calling George Conway, who is a frequent critic of the president, but I think he called him yesterday a total loser and a husband from hell. Now, how awkward must that be for Kellyanne?
He called him Mr. Kellyanne.
Mr. Kellyanne Conway, right. And how awkward must that be for Kellyanne to work for somebody who is openly blasting her husband on Twitter? But I think I saw something this morning saying that she had come out and defended her husband.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So that marriage must be interesting.
And one has to wonder about right now in that marriage. We won't go there, but back to what you normally cover, which is the Congress. This is recess this week, which is why you're finally here.
Yes, and truthfully, I'm glad it's recess. Covering Congress is so busy. We never get a break. It's just nice to have one week where there's a little bit of a breather.
The question becomes, what is Congress getting done?
Well, look, we're in divided government now, so this is a test for the president and for the Congress of how much they can get done in divided government. So far, not much. The Senate will continue to move forward with judicial appointments. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, really views this as kind of his legacy. And it's something, frankly, that he can control. The Senate, he has the majority necessary to approve the president's judicial nominees. He doesn't need Democrats to come along with him, and it doesn't need to be approved by the Democratic-controlled House. So that's the one area where the Senate can get things done on its executive calendar. The legislative calendar is a whole nother story. You know, with Democrats in charge of the House and Republicans in charge of the Senate, I think what we're going to see is a lot of laying down of markers by the House Democrats about passing legislation of what they would do or would get signed into law with a Democratic-controlled Senate and a Democratic president in the White House.
On the other hand, we have seen some Republicans breaking ranks in the Senate with, for example, the question about the end to military aid to Saudi Arabia and Yemen.
That's right. So seven Republican senators voted to break with the president, a pretty serious rebuke to the president, to basically call on him to end military aid to the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Also, don't forget, Diane, 12 Republican senators broke with the president to reject his emergency declaration that he invoked in order to move money around within the military budget to build his border wall. Those were two really important moments, I think, and a rare time when we've seen Republicans publicly breaking with this president.
So why do you see this happening now?
Well, it's a good question. And I'm not sure that, frankly, there's any movement or trend toward Republicans bucking the president. I think these were two kind of very individual things. There were Republicans who were rightfully concerned about our military involvement in Yemen, especially senators like Rand Paul, who's a real isolationist. And that happened to come, for timing reasons, back to back with this resolution to reject the emergency declaration. That was a so-called privileged resolution that had passed the House. It had a certain number of days before it had to be considered in the Senate. So Senator McConnell had no choice but to bring it up. And on that one, I think Republicans were concerned that the president was usurping Congress's authority, that the Constitution gives the Congress the power of the purse, and Congress had already rejected the money he wanted for the wall. And so he went ahead and declared an emergency so he could get his money anyway. And that did not sit well with a lot of members of the Republican conference.
So then the president vetoed what happened on that national emergency vote.
That's right. And Congress will not have the votes to override that veto. So in the end, he wins, but he doesn't win without a strong rebuke from the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue.
Aren't there going to be a lot of
court challenges? That's true. There will be a lot of court challenges. That's true. So maybe it was a little bit of an overstatement to say that he won, because it will be tied up in court. And who knows? It could be tied up in court until after the 2020 election. And we
that
may or may not. Well,
it could.
It could. We may or may not have Donald Trump in the White House.
But you are sure that there are not enough votes to override the veto?
Look, never say never.
Yeah.
But I have not heard anyone on Capitol Hill say, Democrat or Republican, say that there will be enough votes to override the veto. And when you look at the vote count, The number of senators who voted to reject the emergency declaration does not meet the 67 threshold to override a veto.
But you have to wonder whether, considering everything else that's going on, whether that kind of rebuke might be something that they feel is necessary.
Well, I do think they feel it's necessary, especially to assert their institutional power, that there's, especially in the Senate, there's a respect for the institution of the Senate. And I think that senators felt that that was, that the president had no respect for the Senate as an institution and for the words of the Constitution. And that was a bridge too far for them.
So with that combination of Republican and Democratic votes, how influential could that be in court cases going forward?
Well, judges would presumably look to these votes as to the intent of Congress. And I think that it would be influential. I mean, look, I'm not a judge and I'm not going to argue the case, but it just seems logical that if a judge is looking at what the intent of Congress is and he or she sees a bipartisan vote in that way, the logical conclusion is that, well, the intent of Congress was that the president shouldn't have this money.
Interesting.
And that he should not use the Emergency Declarations Act in this way. And I should also add, there's also a movement among some Republicans to rewrite that act. Some will say, well, the president had the authority under the 1976 National Emergencies Act, and if you don't like it, we should rewrite the law. So we may see a push to rewrite that law as well.
And now a quick break. When we come back, more from Cheryl Gaze Stolberg. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Cheryl Gaze Stolberg. She covers Congress for the New York Times. Let's talk about the Democrats. There seems to be a divide that is experience versus newcomers. What do you see happening there?
Well, I think this is the central challenge of Nancy Pelosi's speakership. It's the central challenge of any House Speaker. How do you keep the disparate elements of your caucus together? But in Speaker Pelosi's case, she has this very vocal and very visible group of young progressives. And these are young lawmakers like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York and Ilhan Omar of Minnesota and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan. They have big social media followings. They know how to use their platforms. And so she has got to figure out some way to keep them in line, knowing that at the other end of the spectrum, it's really the centrists who delivered her the majority. It's the centrists who won in either swing districts or districts that were carried by President Trump who, you know, were critical to the Democrats taking control of the House.
So how effective was Nancy Pelosi in dealing with the comments of one newcomer about Israel and Israeli supporters?
I think that is an area where she stumbled. I would give her credit, a lot of credit, during the government shutdown for standing up to the president and holding her caucus together. And she came out of that looking very good. In this case that you're asking about, Representative Ilhan Omar, who is one of the first two Muslim women in Congress, made a remark about Israel supporters that Jewish members, longtime Jewish members of Congress, Democrats, felt was offensive. And she had had a history of making such remarks. She had apologized for one. She hadn't apologized for others. But the long and the short of it is these Democrats, some of them powerful committee chairmen and chairwomen, went to her and said, we need a resolution condemning anti-Semitism.
Went to Nancy.
Well, they went to leadership. They talked to Steny Hoyer, and they also talked to Nancy Pelosi, and they wanted a resolution condemning anti-Semitism. Well, it happened over a weekend. So by the time the lawmakers got back to Washington on late Monday, early Tuesday, things were already brewing and kind of spinning out of control. And a lot of Democrats, progressives, African-Americans felt that, look, if we're going to condemn anti-Semitism, let's condemn all forms of bigotry. Look at Ilhan Omar. She has been a victim of bigotry. Her face appeared on a poster in West Virginia linking her to 9/11.
Right.
You know, they made the argument that who is standing up for, you know, black lawmakers when young African-American men were being shot on the streets of, you know, major cities? Who was, you know, addressing anti-African-American bias? Why wasn't Congress speaking out about that? So the speaker had a little bit of, I guess, mending of fences to do on that one. And it did kind of spin out of control a little
bit. But you don't think it was one of her shining moments?
I don't think so.
Why?
Because there was a very public feud among Democrats that was, you know, sort of spilled out into the newspapers. The stories that week were of internal divisions within the Democratic Party, when what was happening on the floor that week was the Democrats' introduction of their central, cornerstone legislative initiative, H.R. 1, which is an expansive bill to protect voting rights and to, you know, clean up corruption. And that whole debate on H.R. 1 and the passage of that democracy reform bill got completely lost. So that is not a good week for the speaker when that happens.
But on the other hand, from the point of view of some of the examples you've named, isn't a vote against all forms of bigotry and all forms of anti-whatever, isn't that an appropriate one to make?
I don't usually pass judgment on what's appropriate and what's not appropriate for Congress to do because I cover Congress, but I will say that many Democrats do feel that it was an appropriate and very important statement of their principles, and that by stating their principles very clearly in a resolution that described what anti-Semitism is, described the hurtful tropes of accusations of dual loyalty, not only accusations levied against Jews, but Catholics and Muslims, that by setting forth that that list, they had, in essence, put forth guidelines going forward and for their members to, you know, was sort of a message to all members that this is what we stand for. And if you violate this, you know, there'll be consequences.
So perhaps in the end, Nancy Pelosi was questioned, but she didn't really take an arrow.
I think certainly she's still a very strong speaker.
Absolutely.
There's no question about that. And I think where you saw that was actually with her recent remarks about impeachment, where she said that the time was not right for impeachment. We need to look at further evidence. That was really a message to those liberals that I talked about earlier to say, look, we know what you want. We know you campaigned on impeachment. We're not going to do this right now. And it freed up a lot of centrists from having to worry that when they go back home and they're talking to their constituents who maybe don't want impeachment, that they don't have to go home and defend an impeachment plan.
Let's talk about Medicare for All. Now, that's another issue dividing Democrats themselves.
Yes, it is. And it's a big issue. On the left, Democrats feel you know, progressive Democrats feel that the time has come for a universal health care plan, a single payer plan, like Bernie Sanders called for in 2016, administered by the government. Centrists want nothing to do with that. They want much more incremental changes. They want to shore up the Affordable Care Act with legislation that would protect people with pre-existing conditions, et cetera. So we're going to see this play out in hearings and ultimately in some kind of floor debate when these hearings produce a bill. We'll see it also in the drafting of any healthcare bill. There is going to be a big tussle between the centrists and the progressives over what that promise to address healthcare costs is going to look like.
How soon is that debate likely to come?
Not immediately, because there are still a lot of hearings going on. There's a lot of, you know, legislative and research work to do. But it is going to have to come because the Democrats campaigned on lowering healthcare costs. That was their key promise. So they're going to have to do something about it. They will have to figure out some way, something that they can all agree on and feel good about bringing back home.
I want to go back to Congresswoman Omar's comments for just a moment to ask you a little bit about AIPAC and what's happening there, whether some are believing AIPAC has gained too much strength, it has become too influential with members of Congress. That question is now there.
And AIPAC is meeting in Washington this weekend, starting on Sunday. So I think the question around AIPAC is a complicated one. Congresswoman Omar suggested that support for Israel was basically fueled by money, and that she tweeted out, "It's all about the Benjamins, baby," a reference to $100 bills, and she cited AIPAC. AIPAC is a large and very powerful lobbying organization in Washington. It is powered by the strength of its members. There are a lot of people out there in the country, Democrats and Republicans, who care very much about Israel, and AIPAC has managed to harness those feelings. That said, as the Israeli government has moved to the right under Benjamin Netanyahu, progressive Jews and many young Jews and progressive Democrats have become increasingly uncomfortable with the Netanyahu government and also with AIPAC. And about 10 years ago, J Street, kind of a liberal alternative to AIPAC, was formed. And many members of Congress are, in fact, aligning themselves with J Street now. You're also seeing some legislative losses for AIPAC on Capitol Hill. President Obama got the Iran nuclear deal over AIPAC's vociferous objections. That was a big loss for AIPAC. So there's some argument to be made that AIPAC's power is in fact diminishing, and that while it is powerful, and you will see a lot of lawmakers and all the top leaders of both parties will appear at the AIPAC conference this weekend and early next week, nonetheless, there may be cracks in the armor.
You know, it's interesting because there have now been, I think, a couple of attempts to bring people of the Jewish faith and the Muslim faith together, Jewish and Muslim
legislators. Right, that is right. The Washington Post actually had a very good story. My colleagues over there, my friendly competitors, Rachel Bade and Mike DeBonis, wrote about this meeting that happened about 2 weeks ago before the before that vote condemning bigotry. And it was a very tense and upsetting meeting. According to the Post's account, Rashida Tlaib cried during the meeting. It was really, it almost sounded to me like a kind of a family therapy session in a way, and where people were trying to understand one another, but did not really come out of it feeling all that good. And I think we'll probably see more meetings, and you know, some Democrats will say, well, that's a healthy thing. Like, we need, you know, we're a very diverse caucus. They celebrate their diversity. Nancy Pelosi is fond of saying, our diversity is our strength, our unity is our power. But there's a downside to diversity, you know, and the downside is people see things differently and they fight about it.
Well, it would seem that the one issue on which most Democrats are behind is how to defeat Donald Trump.
I wouldn't say most. I would say all Democrats.
And now you've got this huge field. How many?
Oh, my God. I've lost count. Let's count the senators. Just the, like, you know, it feels like half the Senate is running for president. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, Kirsten Gillibrand, Cory Booker. That's six right there. Jeff Merkley thought about it and said no. Sherrod Brown thought about it and said no. So that's six from the Senate alone. So, look, we had kind of the same dynamic in 2016 among the Republicans, where there were 17 Republican candidates. I'm sure you remember there were so many they couldn't fit on a debate stage. They used to say that, you know, the ones with the lower poll numbers were on the kiddie stage. You know, they had the kiddie debate. I mean, I don't know how voters are going to learn about all these different candidates, but maybe it's a great sign for our democracy that there's so much interest in people running.
I wonder if the Democrats have made a mistake by saying we will not allow Fox to carry our debates.
I don't think I want to comment on whether or not Democrats made a mistake in doing that. I think it's a choice that they made, and they are, in effect, cutting off a part of the electorate. Now, maybe, you know, you would say, well, it's a part of the electorate that isn't going to vote for them anyway. But you don't know that.
Exactly.
You don't know if there are some persuadable voters out there.
So what are the Democrats' priorities in the Senate?
Stopping Mitch McConnell from doing things they don't like. I mean, Democrats are in a hard spot in the Senate. They are not in a position where they can pass legislation. When you're in the minority in the Senate, your whole raison d'etre is to block things that that you don't like. They did score a big victory on the emergency declaration, so that was kind of an unexpected win for them, and on the Yemen vote. They're not really in a position to block judicial appointments anymore because the rules around the filibuster were changed, and Republicans can now get those appointments through with a simple majority. I think Democrats are praying and hoping that nothing happens to Ruth Bader Ginsburg and that she does not decide to leave the court, or because then President Trump will have the opportunity to appoint a third justice to the Supreme Court.
What about the talk of raising the number of seats on the court?
Well, obviously, for those with long memories, it smacks of, you know, FDR's court packing scheme, which didn't go anywhere. It's certainly not feasible in the immediate future. You'd have to amend the Constitution. Democrats are just really frustrated and seeing the writing on the wall that the court is going to be in conservative hands, that their best hope for moderation is John Roberts, who is a real, you know, a true conservative. And they're worried about it. But I don't see that going anywhere. I just don't see the American public accepting an expanded Supreme Court.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg, thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane.
And that's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at our website, DianeRehm.org. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher and Natalie Urev-Lipker. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. Thanks for listening. I'll be back with you on Tuesday. I'm Diane Rehm.